Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen and enjoy and send in emails and feedback and things like that. Yep, I really enjoy all the feedback that I get. Luke@juggler.net is the best way to get hold of me in that way. Or you can send me messages on goodreads.com if you're a friend of mine there, or even if you're not a friend of mine there. It's great. I do actually reply to every single email that is sent to me. So if you've got any questions or any book recommendations, just send that stuff my way. That's really great. I hope you've been enjoying the different podcasts that I've been putting out recently. I've been trying to catch up with some books, and I'm a little bit behind on most of the books that I've read, but I'm slowly catching up with these podcasts. Mainly it's because I've been just doing loads of other stuff, lots of work stuff and different traveling things, but also a few musical projects that I'm working on. And which I might actually, once I do a recording of them, I might just drop one of them into the feed as some bonus audio that might go down quite well. I think people might enjoy. Maybe you'll enjoy something slightly different. And also some video projects, which again, I will talk about, I'm sure, in future podcasts too. So if you just stick around and you'll realize why there's been a few less podcasts recently, or maybe not in the correct schedule. But we'll see how that goes. Anyway, on to today's review. I'm going to be reviewing Space Cadet by Robert A. Heinlein. This book is from 1948, and I think it was one of the first of his what's called the Heinlein juvenile novels. And the juvenile novels were written in serialized form for magazines, but then published one per year at the holiday season for Christmas time for young boys. I think very specifically boys, and specifically young boys. Which obviously informs a lot of the content of these books. So there's, there's no girls in the books for a start, for one thing. But I think that's just to keep the, mostly just to keep the books out, so they don't have to worry about any weird love stories or any uncomfortable things like that. But it is a bit strange to read one of these books and realize, wow, there are fewer female characters, human female characters in Space Cadet than I think there were in Little Fuzzy, which is another old book, from the middle of the 20th century, where with all of the different kind of things. I'll talk about that later in the view. So anyway, Space Cadet is a book that I read many years ago. I actually owned it when I was younger, and so kind of rereading it for nostalgic reasons, and also because it popped up on Audible, and I'm like, yep, I could listen to that. It was only like 7 hours long or something, which works out, I'm guessing, to around about 250 pages, and it was a full cast audio production, which is interesting, because there's like bits of music in between the different chapters, which is fun, and I start sort of like humming along with the music. And of course, each of the characters has their own voice actor, or most of the characters have a specific voice actor, which is, specific to them. I'll get onto more of that later on in the review as well. So it sets up like this: the world, the year is 2075, the world is slightly different from what we know it now, but I'd say a pretty good prediction of where things might have gone on from 1948 if science took a different course and technology took a different course. But it's it's plausible enough, except for I guess the Venus bit and some of the bits and pieces. But the main political situation that has developed is that atomic weaponry has gone into space, and so instead of it being, oh no, we can't have any atom bombs in space or any nuclear weapons in space, which is actually what happened between America and Russia, just because, well, actually I'm not sure, I guess it's just because it was going to be a massive ball ache to put them all up there and try and protect it. So it's like, okay, we will keep the military out of space, or at least the nuclear capabilities out of space, and keep it down. But this is written way before any of those kind of treaties were signed. So the idea is that there's the Space Patrol, and they are in control of all of the weaponized satellites. So if anyone starts a war down on Earth, they're sent down to Earth. The Space Patrol is sent down to Earth to sort it out with the overwhelming nuclear bombardment capabilities to back them up. So if anything happens, they go down and say, oi, stop, or else, and they have the ultimate deterrent in that way. And only the Space Patrol have that. And the Space Patrol is a very ethnically and culturally diverse organization that anyone can join up to. Anyone from any country on Earth, except we really only seem to meet Americans. But we do meet other people from the moon, and we meet people who live on Mars and Venus and Ganymede. And also there are aliens mentioned as well, that sort of, because it says, oh, and he's talking the old Venus language, and you're like, well, how is the Venus language gone so totally different from Earth language if it's only, 125 years on from when the book was written? And slowly I worked out and remembered, actually, from reading this first time, oh yes, okay, the old Venus language is the language of the Venus natives. So the Venus natives, the aliens, well, I guess they're not aliens there, but the non-human species which evolved right there on Venus. So the story begins with Matt and Tex and these other characters. I think there's Oscar and Pierre and Burke and these, these group of young guys who enter into the Space Patrol Academy. And I guess they've already done some basic kind of application. It's like, yes, we can come along. Yes, you can come along and sign up. You're obviously doing well at school and, physically fit. So yeah, come along down to Earth, and we'll work out if you're good enough to be a space cadet. And if you get through being a space cadet, you'll become a Space Patrol officer. There are no non-officers in the patrol. You only get officers and cadets. Everyone is an officer because that's the level that everyone, that's the level of capability and intelligence and leadership that everybody has to aspire to even enter into the Space Patrol. So Matt, yes, I think he's from Iowa. And Tex is from Texas, and Oscar, I think Oscar's from Venus, and Pierre is from Ganymede, and there's other people from other places as well. And so they all join up, and they go through these lots of tests, and of course all of these characters who I'm talking about, they get in, of course. And they go through their training, and they get assigned to different spaceships to continue their training. And by the end of it, of course, they have to go on a big adventure, because this is a very kind of standard, hey, we're going to go through school or go into a military academy. You've seen it in many, many movies. You've read it in loads of other books where, they're training and training and training. And then by the end of it, it's contrived that they're going to be in a situation where there are no adults, and that kids have to get themselves out of the situation all by themselves using their own intelligence and their own skills that they've developed so far, and their friendship and working together and cooperation. Is exactly that same kind of story that we've read many times before. I'm not saying that this is a bad kind of story. I think it works perfectly well. That's exactly the same kind of thing that happens in Harry Potter as well. He goes to the school, and then by the end of it, is it the ogres turn up or something, and they're like, oh no, we need to deal with this ourselves. There's no adults around, so us kids have got to band together and do all this kind of stuff. So very, very standard story. And as you reading through, it's like, wow, that's not surprising. And you're just kind of just waiting for the time, like, they get rid of some of the adults and they're like, oh, now the kids have got more responsibility. And then they get rid of some more adults and you're like, oh, even more responsibility for the kids. And then by the end of it, it's like, well, you're just waiting for this last adult that is accompanying the kids to get injured in some way. And of course, that's what happens. And then they have to sort out the situation all by themselves. So while that is a bit of a spoiler, for the book, it's, you're getting the book that you know that you're reading. It's called Space Cadet, and right from the very beginning, if any book starts with somebody entering into some kind of space school or magic school or something like that, you know that by the end of it, the kids are going to have to take over when the adults are no longer going to be there. One thing, there are a few things about this, though, which are a little bit weird, is that, these group of friends, they meet each other on the first day, they immediately make friends. And it's like that the only successful people are gathered together, because all of this group of friends, they all get through the testing. We follow Matt very closely, and then the other guys are just coming in after the same test going, ooh, that was difficult. Yeah, it was. But we find out how Matt gets through and why Matt gets through it. It's mostly because he's not that clever, but he's really, really honest. He's always honest, and no matter what he does, he gets through it just by, like, saying exactly what he sees in front of him, and telling his tutors exactly what he's thinking. And by doing that, he doesn't have to muddle through by himself. He gets help from the tutors. He gets help from the situation by being honest and being completely open. But we don't find out why the other characters who are going through this, these other young kids who are with him, his boys who were with him, how they get through. And loads of people fail to get even through the testing stage. And then loads of people are kicked out as we go through. And the idea that this group of kids who get together and they're suddenly I wouldn't say miraculously, but against the odds, they're all really good and they can all stick together and all progress and excel throughout at the same rate. It seemed a bit artificial that they met by chance. I think if it would have been in a book, like they were shown helping each other and making sure each of the other of the group doesn't fail, that would explain why four friends enter and then all four cadets all the way through to the climax of the book here. So I guess it's just a thing of trying to keep the number of characters down. I remember actually thinking the same thing. I've not read Harry Potter, but when I saw the first movie, it's like, okay, there's these three characters and they're already friends and they all put the hats on and look, they all end up in the same school at school. What do you call it? The same Hufflepuff. They're all Hufflepuff people and they're all together and, you know, and you're just like, well, why? Maybe people who are going to be in Gryffindor are naturally, you know, drawn to each other. Anyway, it's not always, maybe in the book it's adequately explained. Anyway. So, oh yeah, there is another thing here. There's the bad guy, one of the bad characters, because this is always what happens in these books as well. You turn up and the main character has to have a nemesis right at the very beginning. It happens in Ender's Game, it happens in Harry Potter and all that kind of stuff, and the bad guy here is called Burke. And again, I think it's just like going for the economy of characters, not to have too many characters that you've got to keep track of. That Burke is like, the bog standard bad guy. And yet at the same time, he turns up later on in the story. And I'm like, well, if he got so far in the cadets, there's no way he could be that stupid at the very end or that bad at the end. Because he didn't get that much less training than the others, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but when he shows up at the end, he's like, this character who we have at the end would never have got through even the selection process of the Space Cadets, let alone make it to the end of this story here. So that's a not very convincing story arc. What else have we got here for the story? Later on, the protagonist, I've just got some notes, so I'm just going through some basic notes here. Matt, who is the protagonist for most of the thing, he's, like I said, he's not that intelligent and he mostly gets through just with his honesty, which means that by the end of it, they get into a situation and you realise, oh, he's not going to be the hero. One of the other characters who is more intelligent and who is a better leader than him is going to be the hero. And so the expectation is broken. Like, that you think, oh, the protagonist of the story is always going to be the one who makes it all the way through to the end and is the one who defeats the bad guy at the end. Whereas in this story, Matt doesn't do that. And it turns out someone who's better than him is actually given the responsibility and fulfills the responsibility, and Matt becomes a supporting character. Not a supporting character in the book, because this book is about his journey into realizing what it means to be a patrolman, what it means to be a patrol officer, a space patrol officer. Of course, he grows as a person as well, but it's much more about like the training that he goes through and what it's like and what the world expects for them and what the patrol expects for them. So it kind of teaches a lesson about rewarding merit and capabilities and hard work rather than just rewarding the protagonist in the novel just for being the protagonist, which brings me back to the review that I did last time about with Little Fuzzy, where at the end of Little Fuzzy you get the main characters and they win, they're successful, you know, very obviously very successful, but one of my main criticisms was at the end they just give out lots of promotions and titles to the winners just because they won. It's like, yes, you can do this and you can do that, and now you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And I'm just like, well, that doesn't make sense. They didn't earn that. They just happened to have an adventure. And here it's the opposite. Matt and Tex and Oscar, by the end of the book, they thought, oh, we've had an adventure. We've all done this. We've done really well. We're going to get praised. We're going to get awards. We're going to get medals. We're going to graduate. And it turns out they, again, this is another mild spoiler, but by the end of it, they're like, yeah, we're going to be graduated. We're all going to become officers. This is going to be great. And they all go in and see someone and they come out and they're going, and like in the last question that the commandant asked them, it's like, so when do you think you're going to graduate? And Matt's saying, maybe in 4 years, probably another 4 years training. And it's great that at the end of a book, at the end of most books, you know, which set up in this way, you think, oh, and when he wins, he'll graduate. And here at the end, it's like, no, the lesson of this book is, if you're not the most intelligent, if you're not the most capable, if you're not the best leader, it doesn't matter if you think this is your story or not. You're not going to be the person. And then it says, and no matter how well you do, if you're in an unusual circumstance, there's no reason for you to think those skills transfer across into other areas of life, which I think is one of the main, or a massive fault with most stories that are told. It's just presumed that, hey, this guy, I mean, this is the thing that you, with the election season at the moment, it's like the person who's really good at being elected might not be the person who's best suited for running a country, you know, and I don't want to get into politics, but it's that kind of thing that you see time and time again in stories. The person who wins one battle is given responsibilities in a totally different situation. You're like, well, just because you killed the dragon doesn't mean you should be the king. A king should be... don't want to get into it, but this is what this, that's what one of the lessons of this book, and I actually really like it. Other stuff that I like about this book, I'm just going to go through some different notes that I have here. How to move in space. Now, I read this book before, and there's a few scenes which really stuck with me from when I read this. I probably read it maybe at least two times, because I did own this book when I was younger, teenager, I guess. And there's this, the great scene where they're out in space, and they've got these jetpacks on, these, what do you call them, untethered... No, was it UAV? I don't even know what that stands for. But when you're out in space and you're manoeuvring in weightlessness and you've just got a little jetpack, how do you get around? And after reading this when I was younger, I was like, oh, right, now I understand acceleration. I understand what it means to move in this, you know, with action and reaction. Like, intellectually, I knew it beforehand. But then when I read this, it kind of gave me a framework to hold all of this in my mind, so then whenever I think of that situation, or even read the same kind of thing about maneuvering in zero gravity in other books, with jetpacks and stuff, I always just immediately think, oh yeah, I remember that from Space Cadet, that's that scene. And it kind of became a framework of learning and picturing stuff. And it's the same kind of thing as well when they're talking about orbital mechanics. There's some really great explanations of science and technology. It all becomes part of the story. And often Oscar is like, oh, you've got to... No, not Oscar. Matt. It's like, oh, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And he's like, oh, I've got to learn this, I've got to learn that. And you kind of get his lectures and see how he's learning. There's the farming in space and him growing flowers and things like that. So yeah, I do. I think the science and technology is very, very well written and very well explained, to the point that when I'm reading it, I'm just thinking, oh, in the same way in these other juvenile books, when Heinlein gets onto a topic that he knows a lot about, you know, he was a technician in the I think in the Air Force or in the Navy during the Second World War, and so he obviously has been through set kind of like not officer training, but some kind of cadet training and that kind of thing. So he's writing about that. I think he was a radio technician, and I think he was a space suit or an atmospheric suit technician as well. So when you read a book like How Spacesuit Will Travel, like when you read that, you know by the end of that all you need to know about spacesuits. And these books were written before people were doing spacewalks, before they were, you know, doing extra vehicle activity, EVA, that was the thing, EVA, extra vehicle activities, excursions, whatever it is. So this was written many years before anyone had even been to space, but it kind of sets out so well what you need to know about it that it's still kind of, these Heinlein juveniles are still some of the, like I said, the frameworks that I have in my brain when I'm thinking about spacesuits, even when I'm reading other people's stories. What else is a good... Yeah, there's the doubt class, which I like the idea of, where they get everyone together in a room and say, okay, you take this position, you take the opposite position, go. And it's not just the opposite position, it's like the opposite to all standard. It's like, okay, we're the space cadets. We're the space patrol, and the space patrol is super important for world peace. There's not been a war in over 100 years, and people are forgetting what war is like. Now, argue that the space patrol should be eliminated. And the idea is to get all of the cadets, before they become officers, doubting other people and doubting their superiors and questioning everything, which is a really great touch. And I've if you ever want to be really, really depressed, read up. There's a website which lists the last words that are recorded on on commercial flight, like airplane black boxes before a crash. One of the most depressing things, but by reading that, you understand, oh, if this person had just made this question, or if this person just questioned this assumption of the captain or the pilot, if someone else realized what was going wrong, but the captain said, hey, we're doing it this way, and nobody went against it. The person said that, and nobody went against it. So it's a very depressing read, but it's quite enlightening as well, where, with these air crash investigations, how often a second officer or a first officer or the radio operator or the navigator or a communications officer on a ship knew better, but they didn't question authority. They just went with what the captain or pilot said. I quite like the idea of the doubt class or the doubt sessions. I can't remember what they're called. What else? Oh yeah, the puzzles and training tests, which they use in the application process. Some are very far-fetched and needlessly expensive and totally over the top, but most of them, or pretty much all of them, are really clever, and some you don't realise what the test is, and sometimes Matt doesn't understand the test. There's this great one where they have to stand there. It's like, oh yes, we're testing coordination. So stand here with these beans, and there's a bottle below you, and what you have to do is close your eyes, look at the bottle, then close your eyes, and then drop the beans and get them into the bottle. And Matt does this, and when he's going out, he's like, oh man, I only got one bottle. Then he says, well, what's to stop us from just opening our eyes or just looking between our eyes and cheating a bit? And the officer who is doing the selection process and the training is just like, good question, move on. And you realize that they're always testing one thing. Matt is always like, he's trying to be tested for one thing, but he's always been tested for another thing. But he's too stupid, or he's not bright enough, he's not clever enough to realize what he's actually being tested for, but he's clever enough and honest enough that he gets through the tests anyway. He can look at a problem and he's so logically minded that he can work through the problem but not even realize what he's being tested for and pass anyway. There's quite a few sections there, and because he's always a bit behind, he's like, he's talking to one thing. Yeah, there's another note that I made, is that I really enjoy when he goes for a trip down to the planet's surface and meets his parents and meets his brother again. And he's all, he's been a cadet now for a year or something, or 6 months, and he's down there and he's explaining, oh yes, we do this in the patrol, and he does that in the patrol, and he does this in the patrol. And his mother is like, well, what do you actually do up there in space? And he's like, well, we check the atom bombs that are in orbit. We check the nuclear weapons. And she's like, oh no, they can't be above us, can they, right now? They're not going to fall on us. And his father, it's great how his father is like, no, of course they're not going to fall on us because, we're in America, and most of the patrolmen, more of them come from America than anywhere else. They'll never drop a bomb on us. And Matt's like, no, it doesn't. It's not that. It's science. And his father is going, no, politics is the thing that keeps us all safe here. And Matt is, ignorant of all the politics, but he's like, no, the science and technology, that's fail-safe, Nothing's going to just drop out of the sky, we keep an eye on all these things, they're never going to do that. So that's the Space Patrol's job, is to make sure these things don't drop. And, his father's like, no, politically, it'll never drop. And his mother doesn't understand either the politics or the science. Matt's heart is in the right place, but he doesn't even understand the political situation behind it. And when he goes back up, he's like, oh, I don't, it's not that I would never bomb America, but I would never be able to drop a bomb on my own hometown. I wouldn't be able to do that. And the commandant is just like, well, if you would be the kind of person who could drop a bomb on his own hometown, we would bump you for being a psychopath. So again, his own honesty and stupidity kind of gets him through, so he can learn all these lessons. So what else have I got here? Another thing that I enjoy. Oh yeah, there's Venus culture. The aliens that we meet on Venus, or the Venetians, were interesting too. A totally different look at society and a culture, and levels of technology hidden from us, and we just totally misunderstand what level they are, how civilized they are, just because we look through our own lenses. And I guess that's one of the main themes of the book as well. I'll maybe talk about that later. I got confused between Space Cadet, and I think there's another Heinlein book where they're on a planet, stranded on a planet, and there's enemies around, and they use AM radio instead of FM radio, and everyone else is using FM radio, but they use the old school technology of AM radio to stop being tracked from enemies. And I was waiting for that to pop up in this book, but that must be another Heinlein book, or maybe not another Heinlein book, but certainly a similar kind of setting, feeling there. What else have we got here? Oh yeah, technology stuff. I've got some notes here. So I like it how it takes a long time to get anywhere. From, you know, between planets, it takes months, and they go out to the asteroid belts, and it takes a year, and they come back 9 months later, or whatever it is. And of course, this is a good way for Heinlein to explain, like, the orbital mechanics and navigation between different bodies in space, how you can, you know, sometimes the quickest way to get from Mars back to Earth, if you want to conserve fuel, is flying by a Venus, or, like, swooping around the Sun, or doing something else which you wouldn't normally think, oh, that's definitely quicker, but it might be. But it's funny how it takes a long time to get anywhere, except from ground up to orbit. It seems to be really, really cheap to move from, like, to lift people out of Earth's, out of Earth's gravity well. I'm thinking, well, if that's how much energy they have at their disposal just to ferry people up and down into space all the time, that same energy up in space would get you to Mars and back way quicker than it says here. So maybe that's a plot problem, or maybe it was explained and I just missed that. I'm not entirely sure. Some of the fun science stuff: the asteroid belt was once a planet. Nice idea, kind of dated. I don't think that ever stood up. That was always maybe just a theory. That's been done in lots of other science fiction books as well, where they go, oh, look at all these asteroids, and they're like, oh, it used to be a planet. Two planets must have smashed together to make this asteroid belt. And the same with, like, the atmosphere of Venus. It's like, yes, it's very, very hot and swampy and lots of clouds. Yes, of course it is very hot and there are lots of clouds. No swamp, though, that we know of. But I do like it that it's, you know, this is based on 1948 science, or ideas of science. And the whole idea of science is that there are theories that are overturned by evidence, which we don't need science fiction. Oh, no, let me put it this way. This is presenting old theories, and even reading it now, you're like, well, he's got the science wrong, but he hasn't really got the science wrong. He's got the scientific method right by presenting a theory, and then it being negated by future. Maybe I need to formulate my thoughts on that a bit better, with the idea of presenting science in science fiction, and then real science overtaking it, and that being good science. It's not bad science that this is mentioned in science fiction, it's just old theories, which can still be good science, even if they're old theories. Bad science in science fiction is when you get someone, you know, when you get water on the moon, when we know there's no water on the moon, or people, you know, breathing in space with just a little thing on their mouth, and, you know, having spaceships with gravity, even though there's no artificial gravity and things like that. You know, when it's not explained, it can be bad science, but this isn't bad science, it's just dated theories. Maybe. I'll maybe think about more about that. What else do I like about this? Yep, I've mentioned the trip back home already, which I have a little note for here as well. The roll call of past heroes. I like it how he conjures up the traditions of the patrol are kind of summed up in this idea that people come into the, you know, when they, every time that they do a roll call, they said, this person, present, Matt, present, Tex, present, this person, present. At the end, they always do, was it Dahlquist and I can't remember the other names, but there's four legendary heroes of the patrol, people who went above and beyond and you did way, 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 way more than was acceptable, all of them invariably dead. It's like getting the, you know, the Victoria Cross. You can get the Victoria Cross by being, when you're alive. Most people get the Victoria Cross when they're dead. I mean, I'm just off the top of my head there. But it's one of those kind of honours, to honour the dead, to honour the heroes. So at the end of every roll call, four people reply for Dahlquist and this guy and this guy and this guy. Can't remember the names of the heroes. But it's quite poignant how in every situation, you know, when they need a break and they're just like, okay, what are we? We're patrolmen. What are we doing here? We're doing our jobs. Let's go. And by doing the roll call and including these past heroes, it goes, like I say, a great tradition and a great because the patrol itself, you know, there's lots of different people of different religions in the patrol. You know, they say, oh well, I'm a Christian and I'm a, you know, I'm Protestant, I'm a Catholic, and I'm a Muslim, and I'm a Sikh, and I'm a, you know, all this kind of stuff. But the idea of having these four names, which it, like, kind of, you know, like this weird secular religion, kind of like an ancestor worship, hero worship kind of thing, which brings everyone together, that was very clever. So, I'm looking for. I should have looked through these notes before I do. Oh, Matt has a mobile phone. It like very right at the very beginning. It's like, oh, where's your phone? Oh, my father's just calling me on my mobile phone. It was in my bag, so I didn't manage to answer it in time. And I really enjoy the little bits of technology which we do have today, which weren't around in 1948. Which Heinlein kind of just sprinkles into his novels, which you don't even think about it until you go, wait. A mobile phone? Who thought we were going to have mobile phones back then? And another time it's like, oh yeah, well, I'll just put it in the microwave. And he just uses the microwave. And you're like, wait, microwaves in 1948? Yeah, maybe. But yet at the same time, there's other technology which is just totally weird. Like totally, like weirdly off. That I think even in 1948, they knew how radios work, right? But they're just like, oh yeah, we went too far from Earth and we lost radio contact. We went out to the asteroid belt and we lost radio contact. Like, we went down from orbit down to Venus and we lost radio contact. So all the time people are being isolated from each other by radios just not being strong enough or not being able to go through, like, the vacuum of space very well. And I thought it was actually quite easy. Maybe I don't know too much, but we're still getting radio messages that are sent from the Voyager spacecraft, which were literally, as we speak, leaving our solar system, going through the sun pause. What do you, I can't remember the name of it. Stuff like that. Read articles about it recently as well. I still can't think of it. What's the bit where the Earth, where we're no longer in Earth's system, we're no longer in the solar system anymore. We're going out into heliopause. So we go out through the heliopause. So, and we're still getting radio signals from there, but then, like, we can't even get radio signals from Venus back to Earth. And I think we can do better than that. So, bringing two main themes of this book. Oh, not two main themes, but I think in the review that I did of Starship Troopers, I mentioned Space Patrol instead, how it's actually a good accompanying novel to read. And I think this is the genius of Heinlein as well. Another genius of Heinlein is that, and why so many people can enjoy his work, and yet at the same time how so many people dismiss his work for being dated or being pig-headed or him having like one strong political views. And I think that Heinlein did have strong political views, but it's almost impossible to find them out, you know, like all these like super hardcore libertarians read his work and go, oh yeah, and all these, you know, super liberals read it and go, yeah, and conservatives are going, yeah, everyone should go into the army and you should only vote if you've been in the army. Yeah, that's what Heinlein thinks. That's what we should do. And so it's amazing how many different views. And I think that Starship Troopers and Space Cadet really show off two sides of the same argument, that in Starship Troopers, it's the gung-ho military that go in and solve it all, and they have their own personal nuclear weapons, and they go in, yeah, it's like, fuck yeah, let's go, let's wrap up this problem, and let's blow up these aliens, and let's do this and do this, yep, that's what we need. Everyone needs to be in the military, this is where you learn how to follow orders, you learn how to do this, you learn how to do that, everyone's going to be good, and this is what the world needs. The world needs more stuff like this. And then in Heinlein's other book here, that you get Space Cadets, you even get the Starship Troopers, the Marines, as they're called in this book, the Space Marines. They actually turn up in the book, and Matt is going, oh man, I should become a Marine, it looks like a really good life, and it's not, you know, I don't have to learn physics and calculus and how to look after atomic weapons and stuff like that. I can just go and be gung-ho. And then, of course, the, you know, it's explained in the book, like, no, that's not the real cause, and that's not what you want to do. And at the end of the book, You don't need, I mean, the whole point of the end of this book is that you don't go in guns blazing. The whole point of this book is that going in guns blazing is the worst thing to do, the worst kind of mentality. Or put it this way, it's not the worst kind of mentality, but the kind of mentality which will not get you out of problems is going in guns blazing. And I think I mentioned in that review, I don't mind political discussions and all that kind of stuff if you start off with space battles and end with space battles, which is what Starship Troopers does. Whereas this book starts with, like, questioning intelligence and questioning rationality, and even questioning, like, no, it brings up those questions and answers them with yes, like rationality and intelligence and questioning authority is the way to go about it, and ends with the same message. So it's like, you know, they're like mirror images of each other, turned 180 degrees, and yet if intelligence doesn't work out, you still need the Starship Troopers, you still need the Space Marines to go in there and actually sort stuff out. However, I keep always come away with this thinking that if you get, like, a spaceship with the Space Marines on it, and then a spaceship with the Space Cadets on it, not the Space Cadets, the Space Patrol on it, and set them up against each other, I reckon the Patrol would win purely by, you know, knowing how to navigate better and knowing physics better and knowing mathematics better and all that kind of stuff, that they're going to come out ahead. Because, you know, how difficult is it really to learn how to shoot and run and jump and fire off nuclear weapons? That's just what the Space Patrol does in their spare time. What they're really doing is becoming fine samples of human beings and becoming great scientists and doing scientific work and becoming diplomats. Yeah, what else now? Oh, yeah, and the other thing, the final big note that I have here is one of the things that let it down is that, you know, on the first reading, well, maybe not on the first reading, I'm sure I didn't notice this quite so much when I read this book when I was maybe 14 or 15, was that you go, well, where are all the women? And it's, again, it's one of those strange situations. And, you know, that Matt has a fleeting love interest and there's girls on a space station, which are mentioned. It's like, yeah, we're going to go out and we're going to go party with these girls. And there's a woman, another woman character is the Matt's mother. And she seems to fulfill the, hey, women are stupid, they should stay at home and look after the house and not bother their pretty heads with science and technology and politics and the real big issues of life. And so you're thinking, well, is that really, are those all of the females that we want in this book? You know, sort of like a fleeting, stupid love interest who Matt knows he's not going to get along with, and the stupid mother character. And that's it. And there's, you got this other line, I think it's Burke who said this, who is, like, one of the main bad characters, or, you know, he's the main bad character, like, the nemesis, the student nemesis of Matt. I think he says, oh, chasing girls are you? Not me, I'm a woman hater. And then it was just, they just move on with the conversation. I'm like, wait, what? Who? You're a woman hater? And that kind of idea from 1948, from Heinlein's not being that sensitive about women writing a book for teenage boys kind of thing. You're just like, so what is a woman hater? It's outside of my worldview so much that I'm not even sure how to pass it, you know, not even sure how to respond to that myself. It's like, does he hate all women, or does he hate having sex with women? That's why he doesn't want to chase girls, or is he gay? And yeah, it was just such a dated line that hit me so hard. It's like, oh, not me, I'm a woman hater. And I don't think anyone would ever, like, in conversation be able to say, oh yeah, I'm a woman hater, and just go, and then just the conversation moves on with nobody mentioning it. And as I was mentioning before, that in so many other ways, this book is very, very progressive. Certainly for 1948, this, you get, like, I mentioned before about the different ethnic groups that are in the Space Patrol, and there's different racial groups as well there. And it's just like in Starship Troopers, it does it in quite a subversive way, that the characters are introduced and you meet them as people and they do heroic things and they're intelligent, they learn and they're noble. And then later, only later at the end of the book, where they go, oh, what about this character? And you go, well, oh, it turns out he's Latino, or he's black. And I think for 1948, that's, you know, a very clever move, that you actually bring out the human qualities of a person, the admirable qualities. And then only later do you confirm what, you know, if they're going to be straight or gay, or what ethnic group they are, or what race or nationality or anything like that. And yet, this same subversive kind of idea seems to have been, like, offset in my mind by one character says, it's like, oh, we don't care about what colour anybody's skin in, do we? No, there's this character, and he's from, you know, he's obviously Indian, he's brown, and there's this character, and his skin is as black as the Ace of Spades, and we don't think anything about it. Which is it's a great idea. It's like, even at that point, like right at the end of the book, they're saying, oh no, we're not racist at all. Look, we're colorblind totally. We haven't even mentioned what color people's skins are up until this point. And this guy is as black as the Ace of Spades. But when they say that, I'm just thinking, really, is black as the Ace of Spades the most, I mean, for me, that's not a neutral way of describing the character the dark skin of a character, you know, for the purpose of anti-racism, for an analogy for anti-racism subversive, you know, because like the Ace of Spades isn't a neutral way of describing a color. Let me put it that way. I think you'll probably agree. So this brings us to the very final section of the novel, which again is a great lesson in the whole idea of the end of it is another lesson in intelligence and diplomacy and knowledge, and I think most importantly is respecting other cultures, even if you don't understand the other culture, and probably actually respecting other cultures, especially if you don't understand the other culture, which is, you know, quite refreshing. You know, if they needed to fight, they would fight, but they don't need to fight. They actually just need to try respect and diplomacy and intelligence and all of that kind of stuff first. So again, that's another interesting lesson, which brings it back to, like, what about women? Really, there's not going to be, like, where are the women? Where are the heroic women in this book? And then you understand, once you actually get to Venus, oh, all of the Venus people, all of these little alien, Venetian alien people, all of them are women. All of them are females. They call each other mother. It's like, oh, my mother does this, and my mother does that, and, you know, what do you think about your sisters, and all that kind of, and that's the language that they use, because they're all females. And yet we get a group of guys, all of the patrol officers and all of the space patrol cadets, all of the space cadets are men, and they're then having to use the language of the females. And you realize, oh, when they refer to their superior officer, they say, oh, my mother says this, my mother says that. And then the whole idea of this very patriarchal kind of society, it's got its mirror on Venus, where the entirety of society is female. And it's never explained where the male Venus people are, and it's never explained where the female patrol officers are. You know, the male Venus people seem to be these legendary mythic figures that maybe some people have seen, and maybe they exist, maybe they don't even exist. And I was thinking, well, that's what we have here with the space cadets and with the space patrol. This book is written for young boys specifically. And like I said, I understand why he wants to keep it simple and not bring up having lots of girls in the story of the same age, which you're going to have. Like, if you have boys and girls all training together, there's going to be, you know, some, you know, with 14-year-old, how old are they here? Like 18, 19, 20-year-old boys, there's going to be issues there. And here, all of that takes place off the page, like outside of the scope of the story. It's like, yes, we're going to go off and chase girls. And then they come back after chasing girls and they're like, whew, chasing girls was fun, wasn't it? Yep. And they don't need to mention it. But what is mentioned a lot is the brotherhood of the patrol and how they're all going to, you know, bind together, and they don't need women at all until when they'll retire when they're 35 or 40. They'll get wives then and settle down. But up until then, they're just men, and they're all menning together. And like I say, the question of where the women are is, it's like they are some kind of, is there like some mythic female space patrol, like kind of, maybe the whole Earth is run by women and that's what all the women are really doing. They're like doing the stuff down on Earth and all the space patrol. And we never really get that, you know, equality. Unlike the movie of, say, the Starship Troopers movie, where they're all, okay, we're going to go in the showers, and they all have naked showers together, and it's like, woohoo, like that. And it became like a very obvious point in the movie that it's like, yes, women fight and fly spaceships and do everything on an equal footage to men. So yeah, and it's one of those things, like having a story with, like, about Starship Troopers, where it's like, yeah, fuck yeah, big guns, personal atom bombs, jumping around the battlefield, blowing shit up, is awesome. And then you get Space Cadet, which is like the opposite view. It's like, oh no, diplomacy and intelligence and all that kind of stuff, no, that's the real awesome thing. And yet in this one novel, we get a completely male-dominated, not even male-dominated, like 100% male community, society, brotherhood, this space patrol, and they come up face to face with this entirely female society, and yet they don't mention it. And Heinlein doesn't mention that dichotomy that he presents there in this, you know, these two cultures meeting in the same way that he wrote Space Cadets and then he wrote Starship Troopers, but never actually blatantly mentions them or even, you know, again, I'm not saying that this is a great book and I'm not, and I don't want to excuse the lack of female characters and how they're completely done. I mean, I'm just saying it's understandable for the time it was written and for the audience it was written. And yet I think Heinlein is doing something a little bit cleverer here than most people would think when reading this book and go, oh, no female characters, next. I think there's something, you know, I think there's he's being a little bit cleverer and a little bit more subtle, even if I do think underlying that is blatant sexism and misogyny. I think he's playing with it in a way which I've got to give him a little bit of credit for. So that's all I've got to say about this. Oh no, I haven't. I've got mention here about the writing. Yeah, writing is pretty good. Heinlein's standard style, you know, this folksy dialogue and very, like I said, mentioned before, very clear explanations on science and technological ideas. I do have some issues with it though. I think the pacing in the book there's a whole middle part which really drags. I mean, individual parts of the book are okay, but the story really lags in the middle, even though the individual lessons and individual things that Matt is learning are interesting. But quite a lot of this middle section of the book, you know, the Heinlein, he just kind of says, right, Matt learnt this. And how did he learn it? Well, he learnt it this way. And then he describes the encounter that Matt had, you know, he had and what he learnt in it, and then what he learnt in it. So often you kind of get told what you're going to be told, then you get told it, and then you get a recap of what he actually learned and how he reflects back on it. And again, this, if this is written for, you know, 12-year-old boys, that's totally understandable, but from, you know, for reading it again as an adult, there is definitely some issues there as well. It's the same with when we have this, I mentioned the doubt class, this doubt debating thing, the doubt lessons. And we said, oh yes, it was really great, and it was a really great discussion, and they were going to argue about this, and they had a really great argument, and it was really interesting, and they learnt a lot. But we don't read that. We don't read that in argument. It's like, well, give us the argument. We spend so much other time with Matt doing other things, you know, and you explain loads of other stuff, blow by blow and step by step, and, you know, this little bit of gardening and this bit of astrogation and this bit of physics and this bit of stuff. Why didn't we get that really interesting discussion that you just told us had happened and Matt really enjoyed? Why didn't you just show us that? And then at the end of the book, because I mentioned before, Matt isn't the big hero in this book all the way through to the end. So quite a bit of action happens off stage, or Matt isn't on the stage of action, which in turn means that quite a bit of the plot and quite a bit of the action is then relayed to us secondhand via other characters who were there and saw what happened, and then they come back and say, hey, you never guess what happened. He's like, what? Well, this happened, and this happened, and this happened. He's like, great. I mean, it's not all the way through it. There's but only a few passages like that. But I would have thought, wouldn't it be easy just to have Matt go along, and then you can actually, you know, from the point of view of the viewpoint character, even if he's not going to do any of the action himself, we can actually see it firsthand rather than hear about it secondhand. I listened to this as an audiobook. It was a full cast audio production, good voice work. Each individual character, I think I mentioned this before, each individual character has their own actor doing their voice, and all of them were really great. To be honest, I think because there were so few female characters, when the female voice actor actually turned up and it's like, and she said this, and it's sort of like one line by a female, and then that voice disappears again for the rest of the novel, and then another female character says something, and I think it might even be the same female voice actor because there's so few of them, that they suddenly pop up again, and you're like, wow. Because there's so many male voices, when the one female line pops up and then females disappear for the story for the next 8 chapters, it really becomes, like, the lack of females in the book really become noticeable, which is the reason why I think that when you hit the end of the book and you have all the stuff with the female Venus people at the end, when they suddenly do a lot more talking, then the female characters really, they really become more noticeable altogether at the end there. And the only complaint that I had that I made a note of here is that Oscar, who was one of the main characters, his voice was almost identical to the narrator's voice. So the narrator was talking and talking and talking, and then Matt would speak and it'd be like this. And then Tex would speak and it'd be like this. And then Oscar would speak and it would be like this. And then the narrator would speak and it'd be like this. And then Oscar would speak again and it'd be like this. And then Matt would speak and it'd be like this. You know, so the voices all changed except Oscar's. Not too much of a problem, but it did feel a bit weird. So, overall, the story moves quickly, but I think it relies a bit too much on coincidence. Feels a bit forced. There's, like I said, there's a big section in the middle where I was waiting for the story to progress at all. So it was like the middle section of Old Man's War. And I think my main complaint is that when I was reading each section, I remembered reading it before. But I'd realized, you know, like how much of the book I'd forgotten and how much I'd mixed up with others and other things that I thought was in this book. And then I realized, oh no, it's actually a memorable scene from another Heinlein book. One or two things that I mentioned before really stuck with me. Like I say, the spacesuit maneuvering in space and in zero gravity and things like that. I think it's down to the structure of the book, which is, you know, a lot about training. So there's lots of individual sections on training, which is a good individually a good little lessons, but they don't contribute a huge amount to any plot. You know, and this is contrasting with other of Heinlein's juvenile novels, especially, which is my favourite, I think, which is The Has Spacesuit Will Travel. And I remember every step of that journey and all of the main characters, even characters who only turn up for like a few pages. Like the Roman centurion at the end, you just go, yeah, I remember that guy. He had character. He did something awesome and it was good. And in here, Space Cadet just doesn't stand up on its own terms, like in terms of a memorable story and characters. Let me put it that way. It's a fun read along the way. Lots of good lessons along the way, but lacking in the story. But I do think it is comparable to Starship Troopers. I gave Starship Troopers, I think, 3.5 stars. I'm going to give this 3.5 stars again. I think read together, or, you know, taken as a pair, I think both of them support each other in a way which would, you know, actually together they would score higher, but individually 3.5 stars each. So that's it from me. I've gone on long enough. If you've got any feedback, send me an email, luke@juggler.net. I mentioned at the beginning. Also, check out goodreads.com. There's a SFBRP listeners group there. And also you can comment directly on this review. And then other people can see your comments on this review if you comment on my review on goodreads.com for this book. And also I can check out, and I always have it open here, I always check out the Goodreads page for this and see my friends on Goodreads. So Ovray rated it 5, Doug B 5, Jason 4, Brian 4, PM Ray 3 stars. And it goes on down. So yeah, on average a 3.67 average review for listeners of the SFBRP on goodreads.com. So check that out too. Like I said, that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.